facility and look at your structure and your system, whether the care plan works better, whether a flow sheet works better, whether interdepartmental notes work better. What works for your facility and your facility's culture? Our overall goals of care for the resident with pain, when we look at the new draft RAP guidelines, we talked about the MDS as it stands now. What are we going to see in the next round? Our goals are to promptly assess and diagnose pain. Diagnosis doesn't mean osteoarthritis, spinal stenosis, or degenerative joint disease. Diagnosis means the resident has left hip pain. The resident has chronic headaches. The resident has jaw pain. Use pain assessment techniques that are suited for the cognitively intact or the cognitively impaired. And for those of you who received packets of information from iPro when you were invited to this program, there are wonderful tools in that packet of information they mail to you that look at pain assessment for the cognitively intact and pain assessment for the cognitively impaired. If you don't have those, you can go on the iPro website to get those. Those are wonderful tools you can utilize. Improve well-being by increasing comfort, reducing depression and anxiety. By the way, you'll also decrease your psychotropic medication use. Optimize ability to perform activities of daily living and participate in quality of life activities as well. Monitor treatment efficacy and side effects. This is what we're going to be looking at in the new MDS and the new RAPs. I'm going to make it easy for you, though, in your terms of your documentation. Steve Pasek and Russ Portnoy came up with four A's for documentation in terms of outcomes monitoring. The first A is analgesia. Are we getting good pain relief? Have we gone from a pain rating of 10 to a pain rating of 2? Are we seeing an improvement in pain management? The second A is activities of daily living. Are we seeing an improvement in physical and psychosocial functioning? Are they sleeping through the night, walking to the bathroom, attending activities? Are we seeing any adverse effects? Are we being proactive about side effect monitoring and management? Are we seeing any aberrant drug-taking behavior or adverse addiction-related outcomes? And I will tell you, we tend not to see this in long-term care, but let me explain to you what aberrant drug-taking behaviors might look like in long-term care. I'll tell you a story about a resident I knew many years ago who had a diagnosis of lupus and Lyme disease. Any reason to believe she could have pain? Yeah? But what about if I tell you she has a past history of substance abuse? Is there any reason to believe this woman could have pain? But she used to abuse substances. The answer is so. That's the correct answer. However, we found this woman out in the parking lot smoking pot. But she was also complaining of pain. So is she drug-seeking or is she pain relief-seeking? Absolutely. One of the reasons she was out in the parking lot smoking pot is we were failing as clinicians to manage her pain. Once we did a better job at managing her pain, once we accepted her reports of pain and treated her pain, we never found her in the parking lot smoking pot again. So we need to look at that. We need to look at what we do to our residents. Let me give you another example of drug-seeking versus pain-relief-seeking behaviors. I asked the question earlier, any migraine sufferers in the audience? Yeah, one or two or 62. Okay, be my victim for a minute, okay? You can stay there. God forbid, but right now you have a migraine, and I have your migraine medication right here in my hand. Go ahead and ask me for it. She's not even going to ask me. She's going to jump over the table. I'm going to just stand over here. So she's not even going to ask me for it. She's going to jump over the table to get it. But I'm sorry, it's not time yet for your migraine medication. Have any of you ever said this to a resident? Yeah, okay. So now what are you going to do? But you have a migraine now. Yeah, I know, but you're not due for your medication. Okay, so now she's whining a little bit. She's getting a little bit fidgety in that chair over there. and you should see the evil look I'm getting. Now, you're in a room of healthcare providers. At the next break, which we're going to take shortly, do you think you might go out and say, hey, does anybody have anything for the migraines? Might you do that? Might you ask one of your colleagues? Mm-hmm. And if I told you we were going to be here, you know, for the rest of the day and nobody had anything, if you live near here, might you call somebody from home and say, could you bring me something? She's nodding yes. Does anybody see a problem with any of these behaviors? I don't know. They seem like the same behaviors I might find if I went into not so nice sections of New York City and somebody was looking for drugs. How do we know the difference between drug seeking and pain relief seeking? We have to assess our residents. We have to accept the resident's report of pain. We have to look at diagnosis, pathology. Is there a reason to believe the individual has pain? And why are you all not believing your residents? What are your issues? What are our issues? Regulatory and accrediting agencies have recognized that pain management is a critical part of quality care. We can't say we deliver quality care unless good pain management is part of that care. This is a picture of Hurricane Isabel, by the way. I got caught in Hurricane Isabel down in Baltimore, and I thought it was the perfect picture to put on this slide. You know, surveyors, hurricanes, the storm is coming. Y'all get that? Yeah. I think what we're going to do is, it's about 5 minutes early, but I think we're going to take a break now, and then we're going to come back. So we're ready to address regulatory and accrediting agencies and surveyors, and we'll be all ready for that. So we're going to come back 5 minutes early. I'm going to have you come back at 25 of, please. Please come back at 25 of. And we're going to look at how we in our facilities can really do what we need to do. So not only do we deliver quality care to our residents, but so we also don't have compliance issues. We know that regulatory and accrediting agencies are looking at what we do to assess and manage pain. We know that we are being looked at as institutions, as clinicians. And interestingly, I'll share this with all of you. This is hot off the presses. This is from the Pain and Policy Studies Group at University of Wisconsin. This is a progress report card for states in terms of how each state is doing in pain management. Does anybody want to take a guess on our report card grade for New York State? Think report cards, you know, A, B, C, D, F. I hear C. Anybody else? I heard D. A. I want what you're drinking. Let me first tell you, there were no A's. There were no A's. New York, you ready? This is across the board New York State, looking globally. Acute care, long-term care, home care, hospice. Across the board, New York got a C. Anybody want to know what we got for 2002? We got a C. Anybody want to know what we got in 2001? We got a C. I am not impressed. Now I'm going to make you all feel really bad. I told you there's no A's. You want to know who got the B pluses? Yeah, you're going to feel really bad. Alabama. Now, I did a lot of work in Alabama, so I'm kind of okay with that. Kansas. Nebraska. I've done a lot of work in Nebraska, so I'm kind of okay with that one. And New Mexico. And New York got a C. This is nothing to be proud of, folks. If anybody's interested in reading this, this is something, again, you can get off the University of Wisconsin Pain and Policy Study Group website, and I think that is in your resources. What did Wisconsin get? I'll let you know. Wait a minute. C plus. There were no F's. You want to know who did the worst? You want to know who got the D's? New Hampshire? New Jersey? I thought you'd like that. And Rhode Island. If anybody wants to take a look at this, you can't have it, but you're welcome to look at it at the end of the conference. But it's something that you can download from the website, and it looks at how they are judging us and how they came up with our grade of C. We can do better. State laws and regulations with regards to opioid use differ widely. Now, we all are in New York State, but you may have friends in New Jersey or Connecticut. Some of you may decide to retire to Florida. So I've given you a website that you can utilize that tells you the specifics about the state laws, because state laws can be much more restrictive than federal laws. If federal laws say you can do X, Y, and Z, and state laws say you can only do X and Y, we're held to X and Y. So our state laws can be more stringent than the federal laws. Let's talk about the Drug Enforcement Agency. We talked about reluctance to prescribe and administer opioids, and we talked about the fact that part of that is a fear of the DEA. Big Brother is watching. Except, you know what? Big Brother is really not watching. So let's talk about what the DEA says with regards to our use of opioids for pain management. What they say in the DEA Practitioner's Manual is controlled substances, and in particular narcotic analgesics, may be used in the treatment of pain experienced by a patient with a terminal illness or chronic disorder. Doesn't say they have to have cancer. These drugs have a legitimate clinical use, and the physician should not hesitate to prescribe, dispense, or administer when indicated for a legitimate medical purpose. They're not saying don't prescribe. They're not saying don't administer. The Patient Self-Determination Act of 1990 requires that Medicare and Medicaid providers must inform their patients of their rights regarding medical care decisions. Implicit in that and implied in that is pain management treatment options as well. When we look at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and we look at the Department of Health surveys, you may be interested to know what the deficiencies look like. This is a summary of deficiencies from 2001. 2002 is not completely compiled yet. What I'm going to share with you now are the top G-level F tags. And why am I focusing on G-level? Get out your checkbooks, folks. Okay, we're going to focus on top G levels. You ready? F-tag 314, pressure sores. Many were cited for lack of a thorough system for assessment for risk, prevention measures, treatment choices, including pain management. F-tag 309, quality of care treatments. Quality of assessments by the team, care plan updating, and communication based on revised assessments and evaluations, including fecal impactions, weight loss, and pain management. F-tag 278, resident assessment. Each resident receives adequate assessment by staff that are qualified to assess relevant care areas and are knowledgeable about the resident's status and needs. Facilities have been cited for having LPNs assess residents for pressure ulcer status and pain specifically. They want the RN assessment. Those are your top G-level F tags tied to pain. Yeah. RN has to sign off on it, just like your admission assessment. The RN has to co-sign it. You have to. I know. It's a problem. FTAG 309 says that a facility must provide each resident with the necessary care and services to attain the highest practicable physical, mental, and psychosocial well-being. They're looking at pain management here. And this is probably the top place where we see pain management cited at a variety of levels under FTAG 309. FTAG 282, resident assessment and reassessment of a new or chronic problem, including pain. FTAG 278, care planning for actual or potential problems of the resident, including pain. Some CMS survey citations that I've seen. Lack of timely administration of PRN medication. Lack of timely physician notification of increased pain and need for medication. So when I asked you if physicians prescribed 100% perfectly, and I told you that would still not give us good pain management, here are two of the reasons why. No pre-medication for painful procedures. Lack of care planning for ongoing pain. Threatening to withhold pain meds in a patient with aberrant behavior. Now, you're all thinking this can't happen. Let me tell you exactly how this happened, because I saw it happen. A resident was ringing the call bell and asked for something for pain. The nurse looked at her watch and said, "I'm sorry, it's not time yet for your pain meds." The resident rang and rang and rang and rang, and the nurse said, "If you ring that call bell one more time, I'm coming to you last." The surveyor heard it. Now let me ask you a question. Can any of you imagine your stressed, overworked nurses ever responding that way? So when we think it can't happen, it did and it does. The difference is a surveyor heard it. But think about it. It could happen, couldn't it? Jaco has spoken, and they have a really loud voice. Let's talk about some of the type 1s from the Joint Commission. The top type 1s tied into pain management with regards to pain. PE 2.1, initial pain assessment. PE 2.1.1, initial pain assessment and reassessment. HR 0.3, competencies. PE 2.1.10, pain assessment completed within 14 days of admission and reassessment on a timely basis. The top type 1 from the Joint Commission has been tied to our pain assessment and failure to reassess. Initial pain assessment should be easy. The resident comes in, they sit down on the bed. We give them the call bell. We teach them how to use the call bell. We tell them what time lunch is served. They're admitted. We do the admission assessment. It's that reassessment and follow-up. And reassessment is not just admission, readmission, change of status, but reassessment after intervention. Tell me if this sounds familiar. A resident tells you, "I'm having terrible pain. It's a 7 on a 0 to 10 pain scale." You give something like Vicodin. How well did the Vicodin work? Does anybody know? Yeah, and you all have that documentation 1 hour after you've administered that Vicodin with no omissions? Yeah. I know you've got those omissions. I know what these charts look like. And that's our number one type one, is that reassessment. Somebody tells you they're having terrible pain. You change their mattress. Ask them, is the pain better? And document it. Because what happens is we change the mattress. We documented that we changed the mattress. We never follow up if it was effective. Or, this is my other personal favorite, Resident has a pain rating of 7. They get Vicodin an hour later. Their pain rating is 6.5. What have you done? And did you change the plan? And that's where we're being tagged. So that's where the reassessment comes in. If we're administering an oral analgesic, there should be a follow-up about an hour after that analgesic was administered. If we are using a non-pharmacologic intervention, that reassessment should be almost immediate. We need to document our reassessment and the effectiveness of our interventions. Residents' rights and organizational ethics. You all know that pain management is a resident's right, correct? Do you residents all know that? Yes, no, and I don't know? How do your residents know that they have a right to pain management? Because you tell them, right? And you tell them on admission where nobody is 4-plus anxious, they hear everything you say and they retain everything you've said. No, huh? So how do we communicate to our residents the right to pain management? What strategies are you using? Care plan meetings, telling them. Tell them you're giving them something for pain. Tell them they need to report pain. What else are you doing? Posters. Somebody said posters. Resident councils. Those are real good ones. What else? Grievance meetings. Oh, I'm hoping you're not having a lot of those. Quality of life interviews. What else? In my facility, what we've done is, actually, it's part of the tours that I do when I'm showing new families around, even before I've medically accepted somebody or even before they've said, yes, I want to come to your facility. I actually talk about pain assessment and pain management as part of my tours. It's because it's what I do and I'm obsessed about this stuff, I admit it. But we start that educational process even before admission. On admission, we give all of our new residents this little 3-page information book about the importance of reporting pain, their right to pain management. We talk to families about how to report and who to report to. It's part of orientation for all new staff about looking for signs and symptoms of discomfort, who to report to, and what to do if those reports aren't heard. We do have a few posters around, but you know what? This is supposed to be a home-like environment, and as obsessed as I am with pain management, I don't have posters in my home about pain. But I give them these 3-page booklets that they can refer back to. Care plan meetings, we talk about this. Resident council meetings, we talk about this. I tell my residents they have a right to pain management, but they have a responsibility to be part of the plan of care. And I tell my families that as well. When we talk about assessments, pain is assessed in all residents, younger, older, and elderly, verbal and nonverbal, cognitively intact and cognitively impaired. Did I leave anybody out? Then y'all can't leave anybody out because the surveyors are going to be looking to make sure that you don't. We are expected to accept our residents' reports of pain. Pain is whatever the individual says that it is, existing whenever he or she says that it does. We are expected to respond to our residents' reports of pain as well. The World Health Organization says that we must accept the residents' report of pain, that we must initiate discussions about pain, that we must evaluate the severity of pain and make sure our interventions are appropriate. That detailed history, well, we talked about that. We may not want to go there. The Agency for Healthcare Policy and Research again says the resident self-report is the primary source of assessment, that we need to do initial evaluations and follow-up evaluations, and we need to look at pain patterns, presentations, and changes in the pain and adjust our plan of care accordingly. We can make this really very simple if we look at ABCDEs of pain management and pain assessment. A, ask about pain regularly. Assess pain systematically. Believe the resident and their family in their reports of pain and what works to relieve it. choose pain control options appropriate for the resident, family, and setting that they're in, and ultimate plans for discharge. We need to take into account discharge planning. D, deliver interventions in a timely, logical, and coordinated fashion. Well, that sounds really obvious, but I don't think we do a good job at this. For example, if a resident is going to rehab therapy at 11:30 in the morning and they're getting their analgesics at 8:30 and it's a short-acting analgesic, how effective is this going to be? Not very. So we need to look at that. So I will tell you, I actually take this into account when I talk to my docs and I write orders and I ask them to write orders. And I'll call physical therapy and I'll say, what time are you going to see Mrs. Jones? If they say, I'm going to see her at 10, I ask the doc to order at 9. But if the nursing assistant tells me I'm going to get them up at 8, maybe I want it at 7. Now, I know this means that there needs to be an extra medication pass for the nurses, right? No, it doesn't. Does it matter if they get their DIG at 9 or at 8? Of course not. Does it matter if they get their Lasix at 7 or at 8 or at 9? It doesn't. Change the time of the Lasix or the DIG or the Cardizem to match the pain med. Because it does matter when they get the pain med. It's a pain in the neck to rewrite these orders, but it's a lot less of a pain than having an additional medication pass. When we utilize Duragesic patches, I generally will order them changed at 9 o'clock at night. You know why I pick 9 o'clock at night as opposed to 9 in the morning? Because they're in bed. And I don't have to start taking off their clothes and finding them and unburying them and everything else to change the patch. It makes sense. But if they're getting all of their other meds at 10, either make those 10 o'clocks at 9 o'clock, or instead of 9 o'clock, write it for 10 o'clock. We need to be logical about this. E, empower residents and their families. Enable them to be part of the plan of care to the greatest extent possible. Do you all know the saying that if the family is happy, you're going to be happy? It doesn't even matter if the resident is happy. Y'all know what I'm talking about here, don't you? Y'all know what I'm talking about. We need to make sure our families are happy and empowered and part of the plan of care, because when our families are happy, everybody's happier. When we talk about pain care standards, we individualize comfort function goals. As I said earlier, I like to ask my residents, what would you like to be able to do that you can't do now because of your pain? Obviously, we need to set realistic goals. If they tell me they want to run in the marathon and they've got a fractured hip, I'm probably not going to get them there. But we need to work towards realistic goals like walking to the bathroom. And we individualize those goals. Joint Commission looks specifically at rehabilitation therapy, and they're looking at rehabilitation therapy goals and how this ties into pain management. Rehabilitation is designed to achieve an optimal level of functioning, self-care, self-responsibility, independence, and quality of life. That's what the standard reads. Can we meet this standard without good pain management? Can we meet this standard if our residents are in pain? Achieving the resident's optimal level of function means restoring, improving, or maintaining the resident's assessed level of functioning. Can we do that without pain assessment and management? Rehabilitation services aim to minimize symptoms, exacerbation of chronic illnesses, impairments, and disabilities. We must include pain assessment and management. We need to assess all of our residents, alert, oriented, and cognitively impaired, verbal and nonverbal. We need to use some reasonable judgment. And this is really interesting. I'm going to share with you a story about something I encountered in a facility I was doing some consulting in. It was a gentleman who was in a chronic vegetative state. He was virtually comatose. And he has a new fractured femur. We won't go into how he got the fractured femur. That's not the point of this story. I was told by the staff, when I asked, what are you doing for pain? They said, well, he shows no signs or symptoms of discomfort. So we're not treating him for pain. How do you all feel about this? Do you think we should be treating this gentleman for pain? But he shows no signs or symptoms of discomfort. What's that? Go back and reassess. Well, he's in a chronic vegetative state and really does show no signs or symptoms of discomfort. So what is my assessment? Diagnosis. He has a fractured femur. So we need to utilize reasonable judgment. If you were to do a literature search on the treatment of a fractured femur, you're going to find analgesic intervention there, aren't you? Whether it's in the form of analgesics, whether it's in the form of acupuncture, acupressure, you're going to find some pain management strategies, are you not? So we need to exercise reasonable judgment that if it would hurt you, if it would hurt me, it would hurt him. And we need to treat for pain. That makes sense, correct? So they told me, okay, we're going to give him routine Tylenol. How do y'all feel about this? Well, how do you know it's not effective if he shows no signs or symptoms of discomfort? Me, I'm going to have put in my advanced directives, if I have a fractured anything, give me morphine dilaudid, fentanyl,